All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Coming up on episode 392 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the Acura ZDX Type S, the 2025 Ford Explorer. Nicole picks up her new Wagoneer S. Honda Prologue's getting some more range. EREV Scouts are getting less towing capacity. No breakaway adapters at EVgo. When is a CVT not a CVT? VW's got a 20,000 euro EV coming up. And Maserati cancels the MC20 electric model. All that and more coming up next. This is episode 392 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abual-Samad from Telemetry Insights.
And I am Nicole Wakeland from Karmaz.
And sadly, Robbie just pinged us a few minutes ago to let us know he's not feeling well this morning. So we're going to let him have the day off today.
So no Robbie today, sadly.
Won't. No. All right. So what have you been driving, Nicole?
I've been in two cars. Wait, where am I showing? I also got a new monitor and now my whole life is confused. like things are opening at wrong sizes and everything's chaotic. I have been driving, well, two things. I'll talk about the one that they gave me first. I have a 2025 Ford Explorer ST, which is pretty fun. So this is like the, I don't know. I want to say it's the sporty version of the Explorer. Is it really? I don't know. I
think sportier.
Sportier. So, and I like the Explorer. I mean, this is, it's been around for, how long is it? It's been around for a while. I mean, as a model.
The current generation or like,
it was new generation for 24, correct?
It was a refresh for
24. A refresh for 24.
It launched in 2019 as a 2020 model.
So when did it first come out? I didn't even look to see. I feel like the Explorer's been around.
Like 1991.
Yeah, it has been around a million years. So, yeah, so I had the Ford Explorer ST, which is the fun, sportier version. I mean, you can still, there's two engines that you can get in the Explorer. And this isn't the only, you don't have to get the ST to get the more powerful version of the engine. You can also get, this is just if you want all the sporty looking, some of the handling and things that change with this, you can also get the same engine in the limited. Sorry, having a brain cramp. Can you tell it's first thing in the morning? what am I trying to say? So this one also gets, though, it has looks that are a little bit different. Okay, so you look at it, it has inside, it has leather seats that have like accent stitching, and there's an ST logo embossed on the back of the seat backs. There's a flat bottom steering wheel. It has a little ST badge. You get a black headliner. There's black and like glossy and matte black accents inside. You know, there's like a Ford Performance sill plate that's like, it says Ford in white and Performance in bright red. So it looks kind of cool. So it definitely has a different look to it. The bigger part of it is, of course, the engine. So the base engine in the Explorer is a 2.3 liter turbocharged four cylinder. It has 300 horsepower, 310 pound feet of torque. You go with the 3 liter turbocharged V6 that you have in this, your power ups to 400, your torque ups to 415. So it's a pretty significant jump. It's not like a middling little change. I've driven both versions of this. This one is obviously the more fun one. And I kind of like this on an SUV. Like I don't like an SUV. This is fairly big. It's not a small vehicle. It's fairly hardy SUV. And I like having that extra power. And I think, you know, I'm driving it around with just me and Russ in it, but I can imagine with me and Russ and the girls and you know, all their stuff shoved in the back and all that extra weight from four people and all of our cargo, I'm going to want that little extra oomph. So I'm a fan of this. It has a sport tune suspension in the ST that makes everything a little bit more responsive, but it also makes the ride a little firmer. It's not enough that you're going to be thinking like, oh gosh, what have I done? I bought a sports car. It's not a sports car. It's really just like a sport tuned version of the Explorer. You do.
Yeah, there's no doubt. The Explorer is not a sports car.
It is not. So, but it's like, but it does give you like, this will just give you a little sportier kind of feel, you know, and a little more aggressive look to it, a little more aggressive feel to it. the thing where you really notice that sport tune suspension, the only time you'll notice it in a negative way, it is March in New England. Our roads are one giant series of potholes of varying depths and sizes. You hit a little one, no big deal. You hit one of those big ones, you know it. So it makes it a little bit more jarring. But to be fair, when the roads are like this, you're going to probably run into that in almost any vehicle, but it just is, I think, a little bit harsher when you hit those really like, oof, that was a change in the pavement and a seam, or oof, that was a pothole. You're really going to feel it. But you have that sport tune suspension. This one also gets paddle shifters on the ST. They have performance brakes with red calipers. So it's fun to drive. And one of the funny, okay, I'm trying to find it. So it was funny. I went to look up the fuel economy. I'd never heard this before. You probably knew this. So of course there's rear wheel drive and all wheel drive for the 2.3 liter. And there's two different numbers. Then there's rear wheel drive and all wheel drive for the 3 liter, two different numbers. Then there's one more number for the 3 liter V6. And it says like S10 on the EPA fuel economy site. And I was like, what the heck does that mean? S10? And it was only for an all-wheel drive version. That's literally the ST trim. Mm-hmm. And I said, what makes the ST trim? And it literally, all that changes is the combined fuel economy drops by one. City and highway are still 18.25, but combined goes from 21 to 20. And I think that is the strangest thing I've ever seen. I messaged
Ford. Rounding errors.
No, they said it's, well, they said it's because of the paddle shifters. The paddle, somehow the paddle shifters do just enough. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I mean. Yeah, there's the, when they test them, you know, they test the standard one. And it's, I think it's actually, I think it's a little more than the paddle shifters. I think it's also the tires as well.
Could so be the tires too.
There's subtle differences so that, you know, when they do the rounding, you know, they round to the nearest integer for what they display on the site. You can actually download the raw an Excel spreadsheet with the raw data file.
I'm not doing that.
That has the unadjusted numbers. You know, and so, you know, again, when you look at the city and the highway, you know, each one of those individually, you know, probably rounds to the same numbers for the ST versus the non-ST. But they're slightly different, probably slightly lower for the non-ST.
Yep.
And then when you do the averaging, that average number, when they round it, ends up rounding down to 1 mile per gallon.
Yeah, I thought that was funny. I'm like, really? And I, because I looked at it and I thought it has to have something to do with the ST. So I messaged them. Their official explanation was it's because of the paddle shifters. I'm like, okay, fine. That's your official explanation. But I agree with you. I think there's a little bit that tires probably impact that as well. You know, this is like driving an Explorer. It's driving a very nice Explorer. It has a nice interior. You know, it has the B&O audio. I love where they place the wireless charging on this, because it's sort of like there's a little shelf that's just beneath the vents, and it has a spot where your phone slides in, and there's a spot next to it where you could either put another phone just to sit, or like your wallet or something. But I love them when they hold them in place. There's like a little bar, so it can't shift right, left as you take corners. And because it's in a little shelf that has sides completely closed in, you're not going to lose it if you take a corner sharply. That's become my pet peeve when my phone just slides around. Because not only do you hear it going like clunk, 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 but also you sometimes hear it going off, on, off, on, off, on, off, on as it's charging, which drives me crazy. So I like how they've done that. And it's an attractive interior. You know, the red stitching that it has in there looks good. Fuel economy is decent. You know, that those numbers, 18, 25, 20, they're not stellar, but it is a fairly large SUV and you get a decent amount of power. So it's not like it's bad. The best you can do, just as a heads up in this, is if you went with the rear wheel drive with a lower, a smaller engine, 20, 29, 24. So it does get a little better if you're doing, you know, but it's not like this gigantic jump. But if you really need fuel economy, go for the less powerful engine. In terms of pricing, so the ST with all-wheel drive, which is what I have, is priced at $56,260. The least expensive version of this is the Active with a lower engine and rear-wheel drive is $39,755. It's a pretty big spread.
And this year, you know, when they did the refresh this year, they used to offer, you used to be able to get a naturally aspirated 3.3 liter V6, which was mm-hmm. the base model. And they've dropped that this year because right. I think people drove that and said, yeah, I think I'm going to go with the four cylinder turbo instead.
Right. Right. So, I mean, there's a pretty good price spread, but really it, if you're going with, so the Active and ST line of the base engine, the Platinum and the ST have the the larger engine. You're paying a premium for that extra power. But you know, you can get it between 39 and 46 if you just keep it toward the bottom of the lineup. And when I say bottom of the lineup, it's not like this vehicle only has 4 trim levels. And I think especially when the trim ranges are small, when they're huge trim ranges, you can get a base trim that is really, really basic. You know, they keep taking things out to get the price lower. When it's a smaller lineup, I tend to think that the base trim is always a little bit nicer because they haven't gone quite as low because they don't have 10 different trim levels. Like over the years, they've, you know, OEMs, a lot of them have narrowed that down. So I think even in a base trim, the Explorer is a nice vehicle. I enjoyed driving this. It was fun. I think if I was going to buy it, I'd be really tempted to get the ST. I think I'd probably go the ST or the Platinum. There's only a $2,000 difference between the two. So basically what you're trying to decide is, do you want sporty and sporty styling, or you just want fancy with the Platinum? And I think there's too much chrome on the Platinum, so I like the ST.
I'd be inclined to agree with you on that. I actually have a Platinum in the driveway right now that I'll talk about more next week.
Really?
it just got delivered on Friday, and I haven't really driven it much, except to go out and play with the Blue Cruise on there the other day, because I got double booked this week.
Oh.
And so I have the Explorer Platinum and a Lexus LS500 Hybrid.
Oh wow!
And the LS500 is the only Toyota model in North America that offers their hands-free driving system. And so I went out yesterday. I was comparing those two.
You do a little compare and contrast.
Yeah, I'll talk more about that next week.
Cool.
Yeah.
So we'll have more Ford Explorer. We're all Ford Explorer all the time. So that was my official press car for the week, which I drove until yesterday. And then I'm like, you're going to have to sit in the driveway for the rest of the time, because I finally got my Wagoneer S.
Wow.
And the funniest part was the dealer texted me. He's like, Nicole, we have your car. And I literally thought in my head, sure. And the next thing is a picture. He's like taking it in the parking lot. I can see. And he's like, no, really, we really have your car. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's there. So I went and picked it up. I had to say, first
how'd that
of all,
go?
Well, the dealership experience, the people, the service, totally fine. Why does it take 5 hours to buy a car? We walked in at 10:45. We walked out at 3:45. I actually escaped while stuff was happening to go have lunch and came back. And that's, I just don't want it to sound like it's a knock on the dealership we went to. That's every dealership and every car I've ever bought in my whole life. 5 hours. It was basically our whole Saturday.
That's insane. I mean, What were they doing that took 5 hours?
Well, I got there and they told me it was there. They had literally, I think, just gotten it because it wasn't even like dealer prepped. You know, they're still, you could see they hadn't prepped it yet, which is fine. And I think he told me the minute it came in. But I took it for like a drive just to make sure it was, you know, everything seems good. I came back to like, well, we got to, you know, pull off the plastic and clean it and put the floor mats in and all that kind of stuff. I'm okay, that takes a couple minutes, whatever. And we knew how we were doing the financing and the payments for everything. I knew how all that was working. So it wasn't like it was a surprise and they had to coach me for an hour and a half. You know, I'm like, no, this is how I want to do it. And it just took that long. But the funny part, you spend so much of the time waiting. Like I go in, I tell them I'm here to pick up the car that I bought. They know what the car is for me. I get the keys, I drive it. I come back, they take information that I swear I already gave them once already to put a deposit on here, and they start things going. Then I wait and I wait. And I wait and I wait. And then they come over with the options for how to pay for it. I'm like, I already told you how I want to do that. This is what I want to do. I don't need you to give me options. Then we wait and we wait and then go to lunch. And then we come back. And then the finance guy spends like 10 minutes with you. Like the actual process of signing papers and saying no to all the additional warranties is like a 10-minute, 15-minute process.
Yeah.
Right? The actual thing, right? And he's just
typing. You mean you don't want to spend an extra $500 on an extra warranty to cover if you have to get your front radar sensor replaced in a crash?
It was so I'm like, nope, nope. And I know he has to go over it. That's the thing too. Like when these guys they generally have to tell you all of that. It's part of their process. So they can say, I offered her all 18 of these options. It wasn't that many, but it felt like a lot. And she said no. And then you sign that. And then I sit and wait again. I'm like, what are we doing now? Well, we're making sure it's ready for you. I'm like, wait a minute, you've been sitting with this car since 10:45. Dear God, you didn't have a chance to throw the floor mats in. So they're apparently cleaning it, which is at a shop across the street. I'm like, oh, because I'm like, I'll take it dirty at this point. Because it's not really dirty. It's just not
It's just whatever grime collects on it while it's sitting on a truck or a train, coming from
the factory,
Mexico. Yeah.
So then we finally got it. It's super fun. I love it. I've only driven it. Literally, I drove it out at 3:45 last night, and we're recording this at 11:45 in the morning. So I haven't even had it for 24 hours. And it was funny. So I haven't done this in a long time with a car. I have last car that I bought. Now Russ's 4xe is much newer, but it also doesn't have as many gadgets as this does. The last new car I bought that was mine was 2010, and it was a Charger. There was no tech in that car. Did not exist, right? In fact, the guy when we traded it in came and said, "Man, that's like," because you know they have to drive it. He's like, "Man, that's like stepping back in time." I'm like, "Yes, it is. Yes, it is." The process of setting up all the settings in a car, I'm not done playing with it. What color do you want your ambient lighting? How do you want your seats done? How do you want the chimes done? How do you want the welcome greeting? How do you want the not, do you not want a welcome greeting? Do you want this loud? Do you want this medium? Do you want this quiet? I'm going through menus and I understand them all, but it's just like, am I done with this yet? There's so many menus. I don't normally do that when we test drive a car. You're not going to set, I'll check things out, but I don't think about like, well, this is what I'm going to have it set for the next however long. I'm not setting up a driver profile. I'm setting one up on this one. It's a lot to set up the first time you buy a new car these days.
Yeah.
So it was, So the process is fine. I went to a dealership here in Nashua. It's called Allen Mello Dodge. Allen Mello Chrysler Deep Dodge Ram. But they were great. The guys there were great. The manager there was great. The sales guy we've used before when we got Russ's 4xe, his Wrangler. So they're all wonderful people there. It's just the process of buying a car. Dang it, is it painful? It's painful, Sam.
It sounds like it. the last time that we bought a new car, it's coming up on almost 8 years now when we bought the Civic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one took about 2 hours.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
My dealership was a little busy, but I swear it doesn't matter whether I go into a dealership and there's 10 people buying a car or no one. I just kind of brace myself like today, all day. Today we buy a car.
Yeah.
Also, I have to show you because I never get these and this amused me. Look, I have a Monroney car.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Gigantic. It's like as big as my screen and you can't see it, but I just folded it up. Because I save it for absolutely no reason. And at the very tippity top, it says, "This vehicle was built especially for Nicole Wakelin." I'm like, hee hee. That amused me to no end when I saw that on there when I was folding this up this morning. But this is the only Monroney I have this week because I paid for the car. So I guess if I buy the car, I get the Monroney. But not if it's
so from now on, you just got to buy your cars every week.
Got to buy every week. I'm like, can I buy that so I can have a Monroney? Thanks. So that was my experience. So now I have an EV. We have a hybrid, a plug-in hybrid, and we have an electric vehicle. So
are you going to get an extra charger installed or are you
going to just have the one right now because Russ's car charges pretty quick. I mean, it's just a plug-in hybrid. And we'll plug in mine and charge it overnight when I need to. And I just went and set it. That was one of the things that took me. I was like, how do I make it so it only charges to 80? I want to charge it to 100 all the time. I'm like, not that menu. It's like I finally found it. No, we're not going to get another one. I mean, we'll see, but I don't think it's going to be an issue. I mean, when I have press cars that are EVs, we split between the two and it's never a problem. So I don't imagine that it will be a problem for this. I don't think so. Yeah. So now we just are going to see how we, and I did. So it's the range on this. It says over 300. I think when I did the drive, I remember them giving a figure of like 303 or 310. It literally is just over 300 that they give for range. I fully charged it last night because I wasn't able to find. I'm like, it's too late. I can't figure out where the 80% button is. So I did fully charge it to 100% last night. It was about 26 degrees when I got up this morning to drive my husband to the train station for a work trip this week. And it had 259 miles of range at 100%.
I just looked at the fueleconomy.gov and the Wagoneer S with the Falcon tires is 303 miles of range. Mm-hmm. And then they list one with Pirelli tires that's 270 miles of range. So that must be a performance option.
Must be. Have. Yeah. So yeah, so it was fun. I had a good time. So now I have a new car. I had the last one for 15 years. We'll see how long I have this one.
See if your battery holds up for
it was time. Years. It was time. It wasn't like I get them all the time.
Yeah. Smartphones have gotten way more expensive over the past decade, and all it takes is one impact on a hard floor to make you wish you had spent a few bucks to put a case on it. Going online without ExpressVPN is like not having a case for your phone, and it only costs a few dollars a month. Nicole, Robbie, and I travel a lot for our work, and we spend a lot of time in hotels, coffee shops, airplanes, and of course, the Delta Sky Club. Connecting to the Wi-Fi in any public places with shared Wi-Fi puts your data at risk because bad actors could be intercepting what you send and using it to steal from you. It only takes some cheap hardware to intercept Wi-Fi data, and even a smart preteen can do it. Hackers can make up to $1,000 per victim selling personal information on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops the bad guys by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. ExpressVPN uses state-of-the-art encryption that would take a supercomputer up to a billion years to crack. I have ExpressVPN on all my devices, including a MacBook Pro, Windows laptops and desktops, and Android and iOS phones and laptops or tablets. When I want to be secure, I just launch the app, click once to connect, and my data is secure. As I said, I travel a lot for my work, and I have to connect to countless public Wi-Fi networks in many countries. I have ExpressVPN on all my connected devices so that whoever else is on the same network can't see any of my data. That's important because I often have to check banks, credit card accounts, and transmit client data that might be sensitive, as well as filing articles on news that might be under embargo. ExpressVPN protects all of it, and I've been paying for my own account for years. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/wheelbearings. That's expressvpn.com/wheelbearings, and you can get an extra 4 months for free. expressvpn.com/wheelbearings.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
Did you know you can support Wheelbearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media. While you were giving us that description, I did download the data sheet, the spreadsheet from fueleconomy.gov.
You did.
It has all the raw numbers in there.
Yeah.
And so looking at the Explorer, with the 3-liter V6, they've actually got four variants, two A10s and two S10s. And I'm not sure exactly what the difference is between the two A10 variants. And the two S10 variants, but an A10 variant and an S10 variant that show the same 18 and 25 city and highway fuel economy. And then the A10 has 21 combined. The other one is 20 combined. When, the way they do the fuel economy ratings is they have the base test, the test cycles that they run the cars on. And then they, that generates what are known as the unadjusted fuel economy numbers. So they have the city and the highway cycles. They get the unadjusted numbers. And then there's a bunch of factors that they apply to it try to bring those unadjusted numbers down to something that's more real world realistic. And if a car has auto stop start, for example, or some other features that might affect the fuel economy that aren't necessarily reflected in the test because the way the test cycles are run, those all get added in there. So both of these show 18 and 25 city and highway with 21 and 20 for the combined numbers. Mm-hmm. When I look at the unadjusted numbers, the unadjusted city for the A10 is 22.7 miles per gallon versus 18. Mm. For the ST, it's 22.1.
Okay, that's where it is.
Which when they do the adjustments, you know, it rounds off to 18 in both cases. Yeah. Yeah. And then similarly for the highways, 35.5 and 34.5, which round off to the same 25 when they make the adjustments. But then the combined comes out to 27.1 for the regular Explorer and 26.3 for the ST. So that's probably enough of a difference when they apply same adjustments to it that it rounds down to 20 instead of up to 21.
Yeah, and you have to be very precise when you give your EPA stuff. You have to follow their rules. So
And if you don't follow those rules, they will come back and get you eventually.
They will be very displeased with you, and so will the public, because then you're called a liar, even if it was for 0.2 miles per gallon or whatever.
Well, I mean, there have been cases, including with Ford over the years, where they've been off by a little more than 0.2 miles.
Exactly. Normally, it's not this close. Normally, it's like, a bigger number.
Yeah, back in 2013 when they launched the Fusion, the last generation of the Fusion Hybrid, and also the C-Max hybrids, they got a little over-enthusiastic with their interpretation of some of the processes.
Yeah,
because the EPA has very specific procedures that you're supposed to follow when you're, because the testing is all done by the automakers, and they run the actual test cycles on a chassis dynamometer, but before they put it on the chassis dyno, they go out and they have to do things like a coast down test, because when the car's sitting on a chassis dyno, things like aerodynamics don't come into effect, obviously, because the car's not actually moving through the air.
Right.
And so what they do is they go out and run a coast down test, so that, you know, they go to various speeds and they measure, you know, and then they lift off and they measure how long does it take to coast down from 60 miles an hour or 40 miles an hour, or 30 miles an hour down to zero. And from that, they come up with among other things, they come up with a factor that incorporates aerodynamics, incorporates, the rolling resistance of the tires, the drag and everything. And then they take that factor and apply it to the dyno to determine the resistance of the dyno, so that the numbers you're getting off the dyno, you know, take into account those real world factors. And there have been times when some automakers, Ford's not the only one, Hyundai and Kia have gotten busted on this, mm-hmm. and Honda and BMW and Mini, have all gotten busted on this over the last decade. You end up with coast down numbers that are lower than they should be. Mm-hmm. And as a result, your fuel economy numbers that you get off the dyno come out a little higher than they should be, or in some cases, a lot higher than they should be. Like in the case of the C-Max,
Was it bad? I don't remember.
It was 47 miles per gallon
combined. Okay.
It actually, you know, when people actually started getting their C-Maxes, they were getting like 36, 37.
Ooh, that's huge.
And they started complaining. And so EPA got a couple of C-Maxes, and they did the same with the Fusions, and they've done the same to Hyundai and Kia and others. Took them to the lab here in Ann Arbor, ran their own set of tests, and found, Ford or Hyundai or Kia, you guys made some mistakes here. Here's a bill for your fine. And you're also going to have to, and the EPA didn't make them pay customers, but there were some lawsuits that they settled.
And, customers, miles per gallon is not.
Yeah, sent customers checks for many hundreds of dollars
to
compensate.
So what do you think? Honest thought, do you think it's an intentional thing because they think it'll sell more because, well, maybe they'll catch it, maybe they won't, it'll be worth a fine? Or do you think someone literally has screwed up?
Yes. All of the above.
All of the above.
Yeah, I don't want to accuse anybody of doing something intentional.
Yes.
But there's always some ambiguity in the way the rules and procedures are written.
Yes.
And some people are willing to take a little bit more license with interpreting that ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
They end up coming up with some numbers that are perhaps a little overly optimistic. There's blame to go around for everybody. After over the course of a couple of years, there were multiple instances of this with Hyundai and Kia, with Ford, and with Mini. And so especially after the Ford one, EPA went back and rewrote some of those procedures and made clarifications and went to automakers and said, look, this is what we mean when we say right. this.
Yeah.
And told them, this is how you need to do this test. And, and they also started doing a little more of their own testing as well. Typically in any, prior to this in any given year, because the way the regulations are in the United States, manufacturers self-certify. In Europe, manufacturers have to go through a type approval process with an independent third party. So they provide vehicles to a third party like TÜV or, there's a couple of others that are certified for this. They give them the vehicles, they go and test them, and that third party provides the data to the regulators.
I wonder here in the U.S. Why don't we have a third party do it too to eliminate?
Let's not get into politics.
Oh right yeah, now. Politics. You're right.
Basically, they're allowed to self-certify here, so manufacturers run their own tests, and this applies to crash tests, all the regulations. And then the regulators do spot checks. Typically about 10% of new models every year get spot checked at the EPA lab, to try to keep the manufacturers honest. And they did bump that up to about 20% after this spate of issues with fuel economy, the fuel economy ratings. Although I suspect now that number will probably decline closer to zero. And I wouldn't be surprised if the EPA lab gets shut down entirely in the not too distant future. But
who knows? Anything could happen.
That's a whole other issue.
Right.
So a little bit too much detail on the math around EPA fuel economy ratings. And the same applies to range ratings as well. We've obviously seen a lot of variation between the label range ratings for some manufacturers versus real world results. Some manufacturers tend to provide data that is, again, perhaps a little overly optimistic about how far it can actually go on a charge. I'll be curious to see what kind of numbers you actually get with your Wagoneer see if it can actually hit 300 miles.
I know. We'll have to see. We'll see. I don't know. I'm betting it won't, but we'll find out.
Well, at least not when it's 20 degrees out.
Not right now. Yeah, it's not fair because it is still getting into the 20s at night. So,
It's supposed to be 53 here this afternoon, and it's supposed to get up to almost 70 later this week.
Oh, nice. Well, hopefully that weather comes my way. I would like some warm. I was in Aspen earlier this week, and it was snowing. So like Aspen's lovely, but a sleigh ride in the snow, like actual snow, I'm like, oh, this is not quite what I bargained for.
what were you doing in Aspen?
It was for the INEOS Grenadier and Quartermaster.
Oh, okay.
Which I can't talk about yet. I can talk about it next week, the week after, I think. But it's embargoed until the 17th. So it's embargoed for a bit. 17th, 15th, okay. Yeah, it's embargoed a bit. So.
Okay. Well, you're not going to be here next week, so we should record that later, and I'll drop that into the show next time.
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay. All right. So I was also driving a similarly sized electric SUV to your Wagoneer S. Actually, probably slightly bigger, I think.
Yeah,
which is the Acura ZDX Type S. And so the ZDX Type S is one of two EVs for American Honda Motor Company that are actually built by General Motors. the other being the Honda Prologue. And they're both based on GM's EV, Ultium EV platform, although it's no longer the platform formerly known as Ultium.
They're not using symbol like Prince, just like a, you know.
Yeah. they're no longer using that branding. So the ZDX, you know, is the more premium model, which shares more with the Cadillac Lyriq, whereas the Prologue is kind of a mishmash of some parts from the Chevy Blazer EV and some parts from the Equinox EV. This is the higher performance, more luxury oriented alternative. I think it's a sharp looking design. A lot more, modern crossovers, it's starting to veer more car-like than as like, if you compare, if you were to park this next to an Explorer, mm-hmm. the Explorer is quite a bit taller than a ZDX. The ZDX is more wagon-like, which I don't have an issue with. So it's closer, in kind of shape and profile to the Toyota Crown Signia than mm-hmm. to an Explorer. And nothing wrong with that. That's good. I actually had two ZDXs that I drove. The first one that they delivered, when I went out to the driveway and got in the car and went to set up the infotainment, because the ZDX has an Android Automotive-based infotainment system, so it's got Google services built in.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to try to log in to the Play Store and download a couple of apps and set things up, turns out this one did not have any connectivity turned on.
Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah, it is. Because if you decide you don't want connectivity in your car, basically nothing works. The radio will work and that's it. No
maps.
So it'd
be a little hard to test that.
Yeah. So you get, when you tap on, the Google Maps thing, it opens up and you get basically a blank screen. It says, connectivity not enabled on this car. And I was at an Acura drive program this week, and I talked with the Acura folks about this. And as soon as I noticed this, I sent a note to Jake and to Lynn and said, hey, am I missing something here? And it turns out, this particular vehicle, for some reason, there was some issue that the connectivity did not get turned on. It was a pre-production model, never got turned on this one. And so basically none of the stuff worked, including, it was to the point where I was sitting in my driveway and I thought, okay, well maybe I'll connect it to the Wi-Fi, my home Wi-Fi.
No,
it wouldn't even connect to that.
Wow. It's just like no connectivity for you of any kind.
Bad. Yeah. They had another ZDX in the shop at Drive Shop. So they contacted Drive Shop and said, hey, can we get Sam this other one? So I had a meeting over near Drive Shop the next day. So I drove the first one to my meeting and then dropped and went over and swapped it for the second one, which had the connectivity turned on.
There you go.
So this was a Type S, with the performance wheel and tire package. So fortunately it was not snowing while I had this, although it was cold, but it was not snowing.
That would have been bad.
Yeah, that could have been problematic if it was mm-hmm. snowing. And so it was loaded. It is the first Acura with hands-free driving assist. And because this is basically a GM vehicle, that means it had a rebranded version of Super Cruise, which worked great. Did everything I expect Super Cruise to do. No issues with the Super Cruise capabilities on this car. Once I got the one with the connectivity enabled, because that's another thing. If you don't have connectivity, Super Cruise doesn't work because it can't download map updates.
Right. Oh, I didn't even think of that. Oh, that's awful.
Yeah. So Acura, when you buy a ZDX, you do, and the same is true for the Prologue and for all their other cars that now have Android Automotive, you get 3 years of the basic connectivity that gives you access to the Google apps and everything. So you get Google Maps and Assistant And yeah, assistant, you know, voice assistant, voice control also does not work without connectivity.
Gosh, you have nothing. So without the connectivity, you're like, all the features, bleh.
So if you buy a new car today, including that Explorer, you know, you get some period of connectivity bundled in with the car. And then after that, you know, if you have these modern infotainment systems, if you opt not to pay for connectivity, you could have a problem. You basically lose your infotainment system. Yeah. So you have to pay for your car, your new car, in perpetuity. On other vehicles that I've tried, they do work, you know, I've tested Explorer with connecting, turning on the hotspot on my phone.
Yeah.
Because I've already got a data plan on my phone and connecting it that way. And that worked for whatever reason, you know, Acura disables that capability. But, you know, I've had the stuff work, you know, when it's connected to my phone on other vehicles. Mm-hmm. The Type S, they have the base ZDX is A-spec. So you can get it in either A-spec rear-wheel drive, A-spec all-wheel drive, Type S, or Type S with performance wheel and tire package. And the rear-wheel drive, it's the same setup as what you, the powertrain is the same setup that's in the Lyriq, essentially. So with the rear-wheel drive, you get 358 horsepower from a single rear motor. If you get A-spec all-wheel drive, they add a front axle motor that bumps that up to 490 horsepower. When you go to Type S, and so they're doing some software stuff here to limit it, because you're still getting the same motors with the A-spec all-wheel drive and the Type S. The Type S, you get 499 horsepower, so an extra 9 horsepower. And torque goes from 437 foot-pounds to 544.
Wow.
So this is a pretty quick vehicle. It's not as fast as, you know, say at the Tesla Model X Plaid, it's plenty quick enough. It's about 3.5 seconds, I think, roughly 0-60, for the rear wheel drive version. It's rated at 313 miles of range. For the A-spec all-wheel drive, 304 miles. And then for the Type S, that drops to 278 miles. Because, again, performance tires, more rolling resistance. The tires are bigger, wider. It's on 22-inch wheels. They're 275s, I think, 275-40 on 22-inch wheels. So a lot more rolling resistance. Hence, your range is going to be lower. When I first got into the car, I looked the average efficiency up to that point of all the drivers who'd had it was about 2.9 miles per kilowatt hour, which is decent for a vehicle with this kind of performance level, this size, those tires. The temperatures were in the low 20s the whole time that I had it. And so it did not do quite as well. It only averaged about 2.1 miles per kilowatt hour, 2.1, 2.2, which means that, you know, if I had gone full charge on the 102 kilowatt hour battery, I could theoretically get about 210 to 215 miles of range versus the 278. In warmer weather, I think, you know, it'll definitely do closer, you know, based on what we've seen with the GM vehicles, you know, they tend to do pretty well relative to their EPA ratings. So the 278, I think is pretty realistic in warm weather conditions, but definitely not when it's cold. Fortunately, you know, I was dropping the car off. You know, I had an early flight on Tuesday morning to California, and it was cold. It was about 20-ish degrees. I plugged it in the night before and scheduled the preconditioning. You know, told it what time. You know, told it I wanted to leave the house at 6:15, and set the temperature at 70 degrees and got in the car, unplugged it, got in the car. It's nice and warm and toasty in there. That is one of the great things about EVs.
Yes.
You know, that ability to precondition the cabin.
I can't wait to be able to do that, especially when it's freezing cold.
Yeah. Yeah. Between the heated seats, the heated steering wheel, right? Having the cabin air all nice and warm already. So it doesn't take as much energy from the battery. This thing is a pretty long wheelbase. It's like 121 inch wheelbase. So there's plenty of cargo space in the back of this thing. Plenty of rear seat room as well. I mean, the interior is very, very spacious. It's a five seater. It's a two row. It's not a three row. And so that means you've got tons and tons of room in the back of this thing and mm-hmm. still tons of cargo space as well, which is really good. It's also, as are all the other GM derived vehicles, it's on the heavy side. The rear wheel drive weighs in at 5,400 pounds, 5,421. The Type S, 6,052 pounds.
Oof.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got a fundamentally heavy architecture. Yeah. Plus, because it's a luxury model, it's got all the features in there. One thing I did notice, that was distinctly different compared to, say, the Blazer and the Equinox, and even the Prologue,
yeah.
The seats were different. The seats were much better, much more comfortable. The ones in the Equinox and Blazer are on the flat side. They don't have a whole lot of side bolstering. They're fairly wide and flat. They're not uncomfortable, but they're also not particularly supportive when you're going around corners. This one, much more typical Honda seats, very comfortable, very supportive. Really, really like that. What else? I also, the first one that I got that with the no connectivity, that one was white. Definitely don't buy any white cars, please. pick bold colors. If we go out and opt for the bold colors, then manufacturers will build them. That was one of the things that was really annoying about the drive program I went on this week.
Yeah.
All the cars were urban gray.
Ugh.
Yeah.
I was on something recently where the same thing. It's like you can pick one of these dark gray, light gray, or medium gray. And it's like, why do we have three grays? And these are so boring. Is there nothing? It was all gray.
Yeah. But the second one that I got was in the Monroney is not correct. It was not cosmic black. I want to find the right name for this color.
Was it a color? It was an actual.
Oh, it was a real color. It was a fabulous color.
Okay, then you have to get the right name for it.
Yeah. Hold on, just a second here. Let's see. ZDX. Where's ZDX? There it is. So the ZDX. Build. Double apex blue. It's a fantastic shade of blue. Yeah, it really stands out. They've actually got a couple of really cool. They've got scarlet red, and they also have a tiger eye pearl, which is a goldish color. All three of those are fantastic colors. Skip the mercury silver metallic, the snowfall pearl, or the cosmic black. Get the blue, the tiger eye pearl, or the red. Those. We need more colors like that.
So you'll be sad to know that my car is basically like a really dark gray, but there's a reason for it because the interior is radar red.
Red only available with the gray?
It was how it would look with the different colors. And I wasn't sure if I went with something like, I felt like blue and red would be a little potentially blah. So I went muted outside, but you open it up radar red. So I was like, split the difference. So I'm helping ensure that you have fun interior colors. So okay. I still feel like mission completion.
Yeah. And frankly, we do spend, most of our time in the inside of the car,
the interior.
So you want fun interior colors too.
Right.
Which, generally, if I was buying a car, I would stay away from anything like remotely white for an interior because just is not something that holds up well. This one did have a white interior.
They
call it orchid.
They look pretty when they're new and the cream. Yeah. Like sometimes they have like a common combination is like a navy and a cream or like a cream with like a sort of a like a mahogany, like a dark brown accents. They look beautiful, but especially the seats. the color from your jeans, and I don't know anybody who doesn't wear jeans these days. The blue from your jeans colors those seats. Over time, you get that blue, and sometimes it doesn't take long. Like, I've gotten press cars that don't have a lot of miles on them, and I can see the blue already on the seats. If you have a car and you have it for a while and you have those light seats, there's a darn good chance they're going to take the color from your pants, are going to bleed onto those seats, and you can't always get that out. So it looks super pretty, but not for long.
I mean, you know, if you're going to get a new car every week, like Nicole does, like Nicole's going to do going forward.
Right. Exactly. I have another one.
Yeah. Then white interiors are fine. but yeah, in this case, it's actually, Acura calls it orchid. It's actually slightly off white.
Orchid. That makes me think it should be pink. Yeah. Doesn't orchid think like you think pink? I don't know.
Then you can get white orchids. They call it orchid. It's a just barely off white color. Okay. I mean, it looks really nice. That's what was in the one that I had, but it's not something I would necessarily want to live with for several years. I am someone that, you know, if I'm on a road trip, I will eat sometimes while I'm, you know, or have a snack while I'm driving, or, you know, things get spilled, whether it's me or somebody else in the car spills will happen. I don't have small kids anymore, so, you know, that's not a problem, but you might want to be thoughtful about, how is that white interior going to look 6 months from now or a year from now?
Yeah. Depending on how hard you are in your car, especially if you, and if you live someplace where it's muddy and mucky, especially if the floor is a light color, it's all over. It's all over, man.
So bottom line price on the ZDX Type S with performance tires, $76,450.
Is it worth it? You think it feels worth it?
Well, you know, if I compare it, you know, I mean, look at, you know, competitive models, you know, similarly sized two row electric premium SUVs, one of the issues I had with the Prologue is that at its price point of $50,000-ish, the interior felt kind of cheap. It was all hard plastics.
It does.
It did not feel like a $50,000 car. The ZDX does not feel like that. It definitely feels more premium. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, comparing it to, say, Wagoneer S, which I think at least the launch edition, is in the same ballpark as this. Other stuff like an Audi e-tron or Q6 e-tron, a Model X, they're all roughly in this $70,000 to $80,000 range.
Yeah.
And you can get the rear wheel drive starts, the A spec rear wheel drive starts at 64.5. That's in the same price range as the Lyriq. Mm-hmm. Am I gonna spend $75,000-ish, $76,000 on a car? For me, probably not. If you're in the market for something like this, I think it's competitively priced. It's not cheap, but it's competitively priced.
And,
I think it is as worth it as, other vehicles in its segment.
Yeah, it matches up pricing wise. It matches up with the rest.
Yeah, and it matches in terms of performance and features and range and everything. I think in its price, in its market segment, I think it's probably worth it.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
All right. Let's see.
What else we got? Where do you want to go next?
Let's touch on one thing with the Prologue, which is related to this, the Honda Prologue. This week, Honda announced the 2025 Prologue, which gets some mild upgrades, but not unimportant upgrades. Mm. So for 2025, let me find the right tab here. Here we go.
Got it. Want me to do it? I got it right in front of me.
Yeah. So. Okay. Go ahead.
For 2025, the EPA range has bumped up. It's now 308 miles per charge, which is an increase of 12 miles. And all-wheel drive models get a horsepower bump to 300 and torque of 355. It doesn't tell you how much that goes up unless it's buried somewhere down there.
It's like 12. I think it's 12.
Oh, there you're right. Horsepower. 12 horsepower and 25 additional. And
the front drives also go up by about 8 horsepower.
Yeah. So it gets. But the nice thing is, so it gets better range, better horsepower, better torque, unchanged pricing. Yeah. So you're not paying anything extra for that. So it still has a starting place of $39,900. It's still available for the federal incentives. So you can get it, you know, a little less, you know, you get a little savings on that. But there's a range of, like all of them, the range for the driving range varies. Like 308 is, and it's important to look at this when you buy an EV.
Yeah, it depends on which, whether you get two-wheel drive or all-wheel drive and which trim level, because they've got different size wheels.
Right. So if that's 19s or 20s. Yeah. So we have the max you get on this is 308. If you go with the dual motor, which is the all-wheel drive for the Elite, it drops to 283. Not a huge drop, but if that's a priority for you, like pay attention when you're going to buy an EV. Don't just look and say, oh, the car gets 308 miles. Well, some of them do. You know, almost every EV out there has variations between the trims. It's an important thing to note.
Yeah, and for EVs especially, a lot of it, as I said, does come down to which wheels and tires they put on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on the EX and the Touring, you get 19-inch wheels. On the Elite, you get 20s with higher rolling resistance on the tires, hence the lower range. Mm-hmm. And they're also heavier.
So, yeah.
Yeah, otherwise it's unchanged. You know, like I said, you know, at that price point, especially, you know, for like the Elite or the Touring, you know, at $50,000-ish, you know, before incentives, or actually 55.
The lowest you get is a 47.4 after the incentives. So when you think about that, it can get under 50K when you do the incentives for the single motor. So,
yeah. So for something with a sticker price of $58,000, it feels kind of cheap inside. It does not feel premium.
Like I thought it was that, like all these numbers and everything, fine. And if it was nicer inside, I'd be more okay with that MSRP. But it is a little plasticky.
Mm-hmm.
Plasticky.
It is very roomy because you know, you got the same wheelbase, the same longer wheelbase as the ZDX and the Lyriq and the Blazer EV. But you just get the smaller battery from the Equinox and the slightly lower power motors from the Equinox. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think mechanically, I think it's a very good combination because it is a shockingly roomy vehicle inside.
Yeah. Yeah. It is nice and roomy for sure.
But it is pricey, but for now, at least, until something officially changes, you can still get $7,500 federal tax credit on this. And depending on what state you're in, you can also get some pretty good state incentives. Like I think Colorado is like $5,000. And there's some
nothing here. I'm like, oh, you people with state incentives. Wow.
there's some good lease deals out there too, on these things. And that's part of why, you know, this has been, the top selling non-Tesla EV since it came out last spring. So, you know, it's selling pretty well. It's a good vehicle. It's just, you know, it could be a little nicer inside.
Yeah. A little bit more upscale, just the tiniest little bit.
Yeah. All right. The Scout, the upcoming Scout vehicles, if and when they ever actually, make it to production.
I'm so nervous.
Yeah. One of the key features when they officially launched it last fall was they announced that they're going to have an EREV variant, not just battery electric. So it'll have a range extender, you know, conceptually similar to what Ram is doing with the Ram Charger. if you go for the EREV, and apparently 85% of the pre-orders so far are for the EREV rather than the battery electric version.
85%, huh? I didn't catch that. Wow, that's huge.
That might change. That mix might change. because it turns out the EREV is it's going to have 50% less towing capability than the EV, which, you know, is kind of one of the main reasons why you would go with the EREV instead of the BEV, because, you know, you want to be able to tow longer distances. And yes, you can tow longer distances with this, but you're not going to be able to tow as much. You're going to take a pretty big hit on towing capacity. It goes from, it'll only tow 5,000 pounds.
Yes.
Versus 7,000 pounds for the SUV and 10,000 pounds for the pickup in BEV form. Yeah.
That's a lot. I mean, obviously between the pickup and the SUV, big, you know, chunk, but like it's a 2,000 pound difference.
Yeah.
For the SUV.
Yeah. And, you know, especially, you know, when you compare it to other SUVs, you know, kind of in this size class, you know, most of them, you know, will tow, you know, upwards of 7,000 pounds. And, you know, to only have 5,000 pounds of towing. The range extender also will apparently be a four-cylinder engine, unlike the V6. And I think that's, part of why, you know, it's getting less
tow rating,
tow rating, because it's just not going to have as much power available to it.
It's also slowed by a second.
Yeah, it will have 150 miles of electric driving range, and then 350 for the all electric versions. So you're going to make some sacrifices for the EREV.
It does say, you know, there is a statement here in this article that we're looking at. There was talking about they reached out to Scout and they confirmed those numbers. But it doesn't say they're final necessarily. So I wonder if they'll try to do anything to prove it. Because it says, we understand the importance of optimizing the towing capacity for Scout vehicles. Final towing and payload numbers for all models of the vehicles will be released closer to production, which is targeted to begin in 2027. Yeah, that is 2 years from now.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's certainly possible that could change depending on what the customer response is to this. If people start seeing that they're not getting as much towing capability as they thought, especially this is basically a full size truck and full size SUV. You know, these are bigger than the Rivian R1s, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's closer in size to an F-150, you know, Ram 1500 type of vehicle.
They're not small, and they're the kind of thing you would get when you see the size of them. They're the kind of thing you get because cargo and towing are important. Like this kind of thing. It's not like, oh, this is a tiny little thing. Who's going to tow? Probably a lot of people. Like, this seems like the kind of car you buy if you were going for towing.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, this is one of the reasons why a lot of people have backed away from, you know, the full battery electric pickup trucks is because of how much range you lose when you're towing. This is why there's so much interest in the Ram Charger. You know, it's going to be able to tow 14,000 pounds, you know, for close to 300 miles.
I know TFL car or TFL truck, I think they are now TFL, does a lot of testing, obviously, with trucks and towing. And when you look at all the things, if you're real interested in seeing the nitty gritty of all this, they do put some great stuff out. And it's dramatic how much when you're towing and it impacts your range. It's huge. So having the EREV really does make sense, because if you're towing huge stuff, you're going to lose a lot of range fast.
Yeah. So some things to keep in mind if you're thinking about getting the Scout EREV. Yeah. All right. EVgo. Our friends at EVgo have published some new rules. And basically, you know, what they've, The changes that they've announced are related to safety. There are some accessories out there that some third-party providers are selling, including extension cables for fast charging, DC extension cables, and also breakaway adapters. So if you've ever used a MacBook with a MagSafe power connector, one of the great things about that is, you know, if you accidentally trip over your charging cable and you pull it out, instead of pulling your very expensive laptop onto the floor and smashing it. It's a magnetic connector that just breaks away easily. Very, very nice, very handy feature. There's at least one company out there that was offering a breakaway adapter for NACS chargers. I don't know if anybody's actually offered one for CCS or not, but they were offering one for NACS chargers so that, on a supercharger or other chargers that use the J3400 connector, if you were in a scenario where you felt like you were in danger and you needed to just get in your car and just pull away quickly, if you're in a dark corner of a dark parking lot charging your EV, and especially if you're a woman, mm-hmm. And you feel like when you did the cross country drive with the
right,
EV,
exactly. Yeah. There were moments where it would have been nice to think, if that strange car turns out to be a dangerous car, I can just drive away. Yeah, because I was like, hold on, please don't rob me. Let me unplug, and then I will escape.
It's a little awkward if you're plugged into a charger.
So I can see is it looking at the continues to authorize automaker manufacturer charging adaptors? Because wondering about that. So because the Ioniq 5, the new Ioniq 5 has a built-in NACS, but they have an adapter for CCS. That right. would be okay.
And
that
Ford came from OEM. Ford and Rivian and others, are providing adapters, that they have tested and validated, to be able to charge your CCS vehicle on a NACS charger.
Right.
Those are fine. So if you get one of those that's authorized by the automaker, those have been tested. Because the problem is, when you're pumping up to 350 kilowatts through these connectors and cables, that generates a lot of heat. And, every time you add another device into that chain, if you add another adapter in there, there's potential, there's more resistance and there's potential to generate more heat. It can be a real safety issue. Mm-hmm. And, this breakaway adapter, which, is kind of like the equivalent of the Apple MagSafe. The idea was if, someone feels like they might be in danger and they need to get away quickly, instead of having to get out, unplug the car, get back in, they can just drive away and it just pops off. It's just, right. It's a magnetic connector. But they're not validated to be safe, from a, thermal management standpoint. So they could overheat, could potentially cause a fire, cause damage to the charger or to your vehicle. And so EVgo and other charging providers have similar policies about using unauthorized adapters. And so EVgo is explicitly saying they're not going to allow the use of any of these breakaway adapters or any DC extension cords on their network. So depending on, if you are towing a trailer, on a lot of chargers, it might be, depending on where your charge port is, it might be very awkward to actually reach the charger, to reach mm-hmm. the charging cable without unhooking your trailer, which is a
pain in
the
butt.
Pain.
Yeah.
And so people might want to use an extension cord. But again, because there's so much heat that can be generated in these DC charging systems, it's just, most of the DC chargers, the cables themselves are actually liquid cooled. So they have coolant running through the cable. That's why the cables are so thick.
I was wondering, is that what mind, I just thought, I never really thought about it, but I just assumed giant thing of wires that needed to be carefully insulated because of the elements and just being outside all the time.
They actually have liquid cooling systems on there. And you're obviously, if you hook up an extension cable on that, you're not going to have that cooling in there. So again, heat becomes a problem. So, whether EVgo is explicitly banning those devices, but generally I would not recommend using any of those anyway.
Yeah. So. Like there's aftermarket second stuff that you can buy. Probably something that's putting giant amounts of electricity in your car is not where I would do that.
Yeah. All right. Next up, when is the CVT not a CVT? So I was at an Acura Drive event this week, which I'll talk about next week when the embargo lifts. Prior to dinner on the first night, I was chatting with Scott Oldham, who used to be at, he was at Edmunds for a long time. He's now doing PR. He's with an agency that's supporting Acura. And we were having a, there was a discussion going on at our table about CVTs. And Scott was trying to say that Honda's hybrids are not CVTs. And if you look at all of Honda's documentation for their hybrid systems on the Civic, the CR-V, the Accord, any of the other hybrids they've done, you will not see continuously variable transmission or CVT mentioned anywhere. And he was trying to make the case that these are not CVTs. And while Honda does not call these CVTs, they are CVTs. Because CVT, like I said, it's continuously variable transmission. A conventional, traditional transmission has fixed a set of fixed gear ratios. And you go through those gear ratios from low to high and to high to low as you accelerate and decelerate. A CVT has some sort of mechanism. And there's a bunch of different ways that you can do a CVT. The most common ones that we have today use a steel belt. And there's two pulleys. And the pulleys are split in half. And so basically what happens is one pulley, as one pulley, as the two halves of the one pulley move apart, the two halves of the other pulley move together. And so what happens is that belt, which is kind of V-shaped, you know, if you look at the belts, you know, the fan belts and stuff on your engine, you can see that they're typically V-shaped. They fit into a groove. So as those halves of the pulleys move back and forth, the belt drops down lower into the pulley when they move apart. And when they move together, it rides up on the pulley. And so the ratio between the rotation of one pulley and the other changes. And you can, it's because of the way they work, it's infinitely variable, hence the name, continuously variable. You know, with infinitely variable within some range, you know, but there's no fixed ratio. You can set it to be wherever you want. And, you know, like when you drive a Toyota hybrid, you can really sense this, or a lot of cars with CVTs, you know, as you accelerate, what tends to happen is they rev the engine up to wherever its peak torque level is, you know, it might be 3,000 or 4,000 RPM. And then the engine speed doesn't change as the car accelerates because it's constantly changing that ratio to keep the engine speed at that peak torque or peak efficiency level. Though most CVTs are that belt type that I just described. For hybrid systems like Toyota's hybrids, Honda's hybrids, Ford's hybrids, they are also CVTs, but they do not use a belt like that. They use a planetary gear set, and I'm not going to go into all the details, but they essentially use the second motor in that two motor hybrid system to vary the ground for that planetary gear set. So you get variable, continuously variable ratio. So it is a CVT. It's a completely different kind of mechanism from a belt CVT, but it's still a CVT. And he was trying to say, no, it's not a CVT. It's like, yes, it's a CVT. You may not call it a CVT. You may not even, in fact, in Honda's case, they do not even refer to their hybrid drive unit as a transmission. They just refer to it as a hybrid drive unit.
Oh.
They don't even call it a transmission. He's trying to make the case that it's not a transmission. Is it transferring power and torque from the engine to the wheels? Then yes, it's a transmission. So always fun arguing with marketing people and PR people.
But you won, Sam. You proved your point.
Yeah, well, I haven't gotten them to change their marketing materials, but
well, that takes a little more effort. Yeah. A few more dinners.
Yeah. All right. Volkswagen had an event this week as well, where they showed off a cool little concept, with a weird name, the ID Everyone. Did you see this?
And then the number one,
the ID Everyone.
Yeah. That's the weirdest name.
Yeah. But this is an EV that's going to cost 20,000 euros. So about a little over $21,000.
But it's a concept for Europe.
Yeah. And it's going into production in 2027.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the first Volkswagen model that uses the Rivian electronic architecture and software platform.
Are they going to make you put the stupid vents in the stupid screen?
No.
Rivian? Okay.
No, it's got manual vents.
Yay!
So they at least are ignoring one lesson from Rivian.
You know what? It looks very Rivian inside. The pictures, that interior, when you look at the dash, it's got a very Rivian vibe to it too.
Yeah, but it's a cute little car.
It's very
it's a little bit bigger than the old VW Up that they discontinued a couple of years ago. I like this car.
I think it looks really good. I think it'd be great, but it's just Europe, right? We're not getting this.
Yeah, we're not going to get this because we can't have nice things.
Yeah, we can't have nice things. It looks really cool. I think this is neat. You know, and I always wonder, I know people are smarter about this topic than I am, but that we're going to put this market vehicle in this market and that vehicle in that market. You always wonder if they would bring something like this to the US.
Let's see. How well is the Fiat 500e? Yeah,
but the range on that is, what's the range on this?
They're saying about 250 kilometers. So it's going to be about 150, 160.
Oh, yeah. Miles. Okay. No, then forget it. It's not going to do it.
But if you could get it for 20 grand, see, that's the problem with the 500E,
yeah,
is it's $35,000.
Yeah.
This is $20,000.
That's true. That is cheap. But I still wonder about the, I guess it was so city car or very short, just a short commute car.
If you could get a 150 mile EV for $20,000 you lived in an urban or, just slightly suburban area and, your daily drive was, let's say less than 40 miles, which is 90% of Americans.
Right. Yeah. Okay. But I still think I wasn't looking at the range. I think it's too Fiat-y to make it in the US, but it's adorable. I love it. I think the style is fantastic. I love how this interior looks.
Yeah. I mean, listeners, let us know. I mean, if you could get a $20,000 150 mile EV, would you consider it?
Would that be enough? Like it's the Fiat's too expensive. Would a cheap little EV like this actually make you reconsider buying one? This is super cute.
I would definitely consider it.
I'm trying to figure out how that center console works. That one picture that shows the little pod.
I'm not sure what the deal is with that.
It looks almost like it's strapped in. Like it has a belt across it. I'm like, what is that?
I'm not sure.
It doesn't describe it anywhere that I can see.
Is that a little wireless charging pod for your phone?
I don't know.
Or something?
I can't see anything describing what that does. It, this is a concept, so it just might have been look pretty in the pictures kind of thing. But
yeah, I suspect that'll probably evolve.
Yeah,
but it is a cool manual vents all around. Buttons on the steering wheel.
Woohoo!
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah, it looks good.
I would absolutely consider this for 20 grand.
Yeah.
Let's see. At a slightly higher price point, the Maserati MC20.
Slightly higher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. 10-15x difference.
Sure. In price. Slightly same.
Moderately more expensive. Anyway, plans for the MC20 Folgore, which was going to be all electric, have apparently been canceled. Apparently the powers that be at Stellantis have been taking a new look at Maserati and trying to determine, why are we spending so many billions on Maserati given the level of sales that they have?
How few Maseratis are selling. And it looks like it also says in here, the next gen of the Levante was supposed to come into 2027, but they don't know about that. And the Quattroporte has been delayed until 2028, and things aren't looking great at Maserati.
No, they're really nice cars. I mean, I've driven the MC20, I've driven the Levante and the Grecale, they were fabulous to drive.
The last time I drove, and I can't remember which ones at this point, but it was on a track like back before COVID at a thing that FCA did out in Michigan. And we had the chance to drive some Maseratis, and they were incredible. The interiors were just beautiful, exactly what you'd want from that kind of vehicle. They were great, but they are not inexpensive. They are not cheap. Yeah, they are definitely premium.
Yeah, I mean, these are you know, very high end.
Oh yeah,
luxury sports cars.
Yeah, they're very, very high end. So it's always going to be a small number that are sold. But if it's a really, really small number, that's a really, really small profit, and then you have a problem.
Yeah, I Maserati has come to the conclusion that the market for electric supercars just doesn't really exist.
Doesn't really isn't there the way they hoped.
Yeah. So back in the early 1990s in New Hampshire, did your New Hampshire State Police ever drive Mustangs?
I don't remember them driving Mustangs. I don't remember, okay, to say it this way. I never remember being afraid of Mustangs behind me being something other than just a Mustang. I've always been afraid of Chargers, so I don't think we had these.
Well, back starting in about 1987 or 88, Ford did offer a police package for the Mustang, the 5-liter LX notchback, which I happen to have owned a 1991 5-liter LX notchback.
No kidding.
And had a lot of fun with that car. That was what I bought myself as a graduation present when I graduated.
Nice.
Yeah. And had a lot of fun with that car. But the Michigan State Police were among numerous police agencies around the country, including California Highway Patrol. And apparently the North Carolina and Florida also had them, that had these police package Mustangs that they used to catch speeders. And Ford, you know, sold those until the end of the Fox Body era in 93. And then hadn't offered a factory police package for the Mustang since then. But the, North Carolina State Police, have, purchased some, 2024, V8 Mustang GTs. And had them outfitted for police service with some graphics, no light bars, which is going to make this problematic. At least, you know, here in Michigan, you know, the Michigan State Police vehicles always have and continue to have the red dome flasher on the top. And so, you know, you could, you know, you were looking in your mirror, if you saw that red dome, you knew you were toast.
Your goose was cooked.
Yep. these 25 Mustangs that they bought, they don't have any light bars or anything. So, you know, presumably there will be some flashers built into the front fascia or behind the windshield that will turn on when it's time for you to pull over. But they're putting these in service in North Carolina.
Got to be a little careful, and I got to warn Rose. That's where my daughter lives.
Yeah.
Slow it down, child.
Watch out for Mustangs. All right. Let's see. What are we doing for time? So in the UK, EV sales have not slowed down this year. They are now accounting for 1/4 of all new vehicle sales, and internal combustion vehicles were down pretty significantly in the first couple months of the year. They were down over 20% or sorry, 16% of internal combustion vehicles were down, but 42% increase in EV sales so far in 2025.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did anything, I'm reading through this. Is there anything that made that happen? Like
there is a tax change coming up in April.
There we go. I see it.
So, April 1st. Yeah. So they're going to be
new vehicle excise duty of 200 pounds, just about 195. So $200. And let's see. Oh my gosh. And if you drive an EV with a list price over 40,000 pounds, you have to pay a supplement of 3,100 pounds over the first 6 years. So there's a chunk of money coming that you're going to have to pay. So that could be part of it. I wonder how much of that is just they're doing good versus, oh crud, we can't wait.
Well, I mean, they were doing good. You know, their sales were still up in 2024 as well. And you know, they're generally EVs are doing well across Europe. So far through the first 2 months of the year, across Europe, EV sales have been up about 35%, compared to 2024. And at the same time, Tesla sales are down about 40%. So, their EV sales are up despite the fact that Tesla sales are crashing across most of Europe. Tesla sales were up in the UK in February. So I think, Tesla is trying to move some vehicles, but they're in the rest of Europe, Tesla sales are crashing.
The best selling car in the UK last month was the Mini Cooper.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Although it was followed by, sales might be down, but then it was, I'm just reading further down in the story. It was followed by the Model 3 and then the Model Y.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also in the UK, Volvo EX90 customers, they've only recently started shipping the EX90 there. So the EX90 is built here in South Carolina, and along with the Polestar 3. And couple weeks ago, we talked about the S90 that was just officially fully launched this week, which is the sedanish, hatchbackish, crossoverish model that replaces the S90 or supplements the S90. The ES90 is getting an upgraded version of the computer that launched in the EX90. So the EX90, when they started building them last fall, its main chassis computer for the driver assistance stuff used a single NVIDIA Orin SoC to power all that. So NVIDIA or Volvo on the new SPA2 platform has, they've gone to a more centralized computer architecture. So they've got two main computers, one for the body that's running on a Qualcomm chip, and then one for the chassis controls that runs on an NVIDIA chip. The EX90 launched with a single Orin system. And this is a chip that is very powerful, but also quite pricey. It's the ES90, the sedan, is launching with a dual Orin system. And Volvo, at least in the UK, is saying that customers that buy an EX90 that have the single Orin system in there will get an upgrade to the dual Orin computer.
That's nice.
I've reached out to Russ Datz at Volvo here in the US, and they haven't confirmed anything. They haven't announced anything yet for the US market, but I'm guessing that if they're offering this upgrade for EX90s, in at least in the UK, we'll probably see that here. It may or may not be a free upgrade. You may have to pay for it. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I can imagine they wouldn't at least offer it somehow, if not free, at least pay for it if people want it.
Yeah. All right, let's answer some listener questions.
Okay.
First up, from Scott. On a recent podcast, you were discussing returning an EV to a Hertz location and how it's impossible to return it with a full charge. I'm renting an EV from Hertz next week, and the policy is as follows. You recharge. If you return the EV at the same battery level it had when you picked it up, there's no extra charge. However, you don't have to return the vehicle with more than 75% charge. So no more than 75% is necessary. I did not actually read the documentation that came with my rental, but I asked the rep at the Hertz counter when I got the key for the Polestar I was driving, and she said 80%.
I wonder if they may have changed it. I know Russ rented his EV at a Hertz. It's a little while ago now. And at that time it was telling him you had to return it fully charged was what it said. And I was like, fully charged?
It was basically the same policy they've always had for gas vehicles.
Right. It didn't look like it had adjusted for the fact that it was electric. Now, like I said, that was a few years back. So it may have been because it was early enough in there that they weren't somebody who wasn't really thinking said fully charged. And it's like, we can't do that depending on where the last charging station is. And I remember him specifically being irritated that he got a vehicle at like say 40%. He's like, now I got to charge this sucker back up and just give them fuel essentially. So that's good. If it says that, if it's only at either the battery level you had or 75% is considered full, that's actually pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, and, the thing is, with EVs, they give you a digital readout on an EV of what your state of charge is, So, it could read, 97, 98, 99%. Whereas with a fuel a combustion vehicle, you know, you've got a fuel gauge that, you know, doesn't show you percentage. You know, you can drive a couple of miles usually, and it's still showing full.
Right. So, like full is a little bit wishy-washy because you can't see the exact percentage. You just, well, the needle looks like it's already over there. Sure. Or like, you know, it's a little tricky to tell.
So even if you charge to 100%, and you know, the thing is that last 10% or 15% usually takes a long time to fill up. And so if you, you know, even if you stop at the closest charger to a Hertz outlet and you charge it to 100%, by the time you get from that charger to the Hertz location, it's usually going to be down to at least 99 or 98%. Right. So, you know, having, you know, a buffer like 75 or 80%, I think is pretty reasonable.
It does. That makes sense. That's good. That's a good call on Hertz's part. Good job, Hertz.
All right. Next up from Chinton. This is, hey, Nicole, Roberto, and Sam. First of all, thanks for putting on such a great show every week. We enjoyed doing it. I think Sam needs to update his bio on the website. I have done that.
I swear I thought we saw this question before, but maybe we didn't. Did we?
I know we talked about.
Or did we just talk about.
We talked about the brake lights.
Yeah.
Coming on. Because this one just came in a couple of days ago.
Oh, then we must have for somebody. I'm like, wait, I feel like we just talked about brake lights. Sorry, go ahead.
So anyway, stumbled across this video today on YouTube, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Relates to stop lamps, brake lights, on Hyundai Motor Group's EGMP cars. In short, according to this video, those vehicles did not activate their stop lamps when one-pedal driving mode was engaged, or rather, they only activated them at the very end when the car was almost fully stopped. And that is true. We did discuss that a couple weeks back after we were talking about the 2025 Ioniq 5s. Hmm. And this is something that when they first launched the EGMP cars, this was an issue. Hyundai subsequently fixed it. So all the EGMP cars now do activate the brake lights when you lift off the accelerator pedal. So this... it was a genuine issue, but now it no longer is. It says, Chinton goes on, my BMW EV activates its stop lamps as you would expect when it has fully engaged regenerative braking with enough force to cause the car to slow like a friction brake. However, I did not realize other car companies did not apply the same logic. In fact, according to the video, the Federal Highway Motor Vehicle Safety Standards do not require stop lamps to be engaged at all during regenerative braking. That's true. You know, those rules were written long before we had regen braking. Hence,
they're notoriously outdated rules, which is why we don't get cool stuff over here too. It's such a huge thing to change. There's good stuff we can't get for exactly the same reason.
Yeah. So do you have any experience with this yourselves? Don't you think that this is a massive safety problem if other car companies handle it the same way as Hyundai does? By the way, I wrote in a year ago asking about the type of car I would get, my kid, he wanted an old A6 3.0T. We ended up getting him a 2018 Golf GTI, and he loves it, despite not having more than 330 horsepower. Thanks, and keep the podcast coming. I think every other automaker does this the right way. Basically, rather than tying the brake lamp control now to the brake switch, which is the way it used to be, they now just look at vehicle decel. You know, because all modern vehicles have accelerometers in there. They've got various other sensors that can tell how fast the car is decelerating. Once you hit, typically the threshold is 0.05 Gs, which is about what you'll get, you know, from an internal combustion vehicle. Up to that point is what you'll get from engine braking. And then beyond that, you know, you've got to apply the brakes. So it's usually somewhere around 0.05 Gs decel. Then they will turn on the brake lamps. And they also, one of the things that was mentioned in the video, I watched about half of it so far, is, you know, if you're using adaptive cruise control and your car slows down in response to the vehicle you're following, they will also turn on the brake lamps. So, finally from Adam J, longtime listener. In case this doesn't make your news roundup on an upcoming episode, thought I'd share a follow-up to my email below. I'm not part of this lawsuit, but maybe this will prompt some future redesign. Currently, I store a portable jumper box with my with my neighbors who know what it's for, to come bring it to wherever I might be stranded and locked out of the vehicle if the 12-volt battery dies, because I can't store it in the car. And I know this would be faster than waiting for a tow truck, which took 3 hours to arrive last time I used Ford roadside assistance. I love everything about my Mach-E except this design flaw. So hopefully this will provide prompt a change. And there's a link here to a class action lawsuit over the Mach-E over the door locks. Let's see.
So basically the doors aren't unlocked. The doors refusing to open while others have found the system unresponsive or locking them out unexpectedly if the vehicle's battery dies. So California owners have launched a class action lawsuit.
So, you know, the Mach-E, you know, was the first one to launch with the system, and they used the same system on the Cadillac Lyriq for the first model year and then changed to a conventional door handles. And they also used the same system on the Cybertruck, where, you know, you press a button or press somewhere on the door, and there's a piston in the door that pops the door open a couple of inches, and then you pull the door open from there. And when they launched the Mach-E, I talked to Ford people about this. You know, what happens if the battery dies? How do you get in the car? And what they told me at the time was that there's actually a capacitor in the door, so that if your battery voltage drops below a certain threshold, the capacitor will provide the power. It should be able to provide enough power to open and close the door at least a couple of times. Apparently this is maybe not happening properly on the Mach-E, or it's not working properly. You know, because on most other cars that have, you know, are pretty much all modern cars that have central locking systems, keyless entry systems, what you'll actually find is in your fob, there's actually a mechanical key that you can pull out. And somewhere in the vicinity of the door handle, there's mm-hmm. a cap typically that you can pull off that is hiding a traditional little keyhole. And yep. you can stick that in there and mechanically unlock the door. That obviously is not the case on the Mach-E. You know, so there's no way to connect external power to the, you know, to a lot of these EVs when, you know, or to, you know, to the 12 volts. The Mach-E is supposed to be able to do this. You know, it's supposed to have these capacitors in there. I don't know if it's not working.
Yeah.
You know, there is a class action lawsuit about this, and hopefully Ford will do something to correct the situation.
To fix the problem. Yes. Yep.
And that's it for this week. Thank you all for listening. Hopefully Robbie will be back next week, but sadly Nicole will not. Well,
I'll be gone.
She will not be with us live.
Yes. I will not be with you live. I'll be off gallivanting with, in Disney World, taking a weekend to run away.
Yeah. But we will have our buddy Perry Stern joining us again next week. And then the following week, Stephanie Brindley is going to be back with us again as well.
Perfect. And then I'll be back. I promise. Yeah. Eventually.
Yeah. Eventually. All right. Thanks everybody. And we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to say, ahoy, or land ho, and not feel weird about it. So here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance offers access to the largest towing fleet on the water. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to say, shiver me timbers, and not feel weird about that either. Get more with GEICO.